Hello, PNMers. Happy Thursday, February 18th, 2021. My name is Anita Nsubiga. I'm one of the Jolie PNM crew. And today I'm joined by Tiffany Green, assistant professor from UW-Madison Population Health Sciences. Hi, Dr. Tiffany Green. Let everybody know about yourself. And thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Anita. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yes, I'm so glad to have you here. And in light of Black History Month, I figured it would be a great chance to talk about one of the central topics this year and last year, racism in our society. I'm hoping that through this discussion, we are able to see what the effects of racism are on people of color, specifically African Americans. And so hopefully we can definitely dive into this topic and get, sort of more clarity on what racism is and how to be better citizens, holistically, not just people of color, but other people, and understanding those issues. So I will definitely start with myself. I am a Black woman in the science field. I work in epidemiology, and I'm definitely really interested in race and health disparities. And last year was definitely a tough year for a lot of people, and especially in that realm. So, let everybody know about you, what you do, and what research you work on.
Sure. I came to this in a somewhat roundabout way. I'm an economist by training. My PhD is in economics. And a lot of people say, well, how do you study health? I actually studied health economics in grad school and realized I didn't know much about health. So I applied to the Robert Wood Johnson Health and Society Scholars Program here at UW-Madison many years ago. And I did that postdoc and a second postdoc. And I left for another faculty position, but then UW had a call for a cluster hire in reproductive equity. And of course, I was like, well, man, I have to come back. And that's why I'm here. My work really focuses on the causes and consequences of racial and ethnic disparities in reproductive health. And while at the beginning of my career, I focused a lot more on birth outcomes, I'm really thinking about the whole pregnant person. People, women and other folks that give birth are certainly much more than gestational carriers. They're whole human beings in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in, from a reproductive justice framework, how people are able to get pregnant or not get pregnant if they'd like, or stay pregnant. Whether they can give birth safely and whether they can raise their children in safety. And so my research agenda really focuses not on the individual level factors that drive these racial disparities and outcomes, but the structures and institutions that create these inequities, with an eye towards finding a path forward for solving them.
Wow, thank you. That's definitely something I've also been really intrigued by. I've read, and definitely correct me if I'm wrong, the birth in terms of pregnancy fatality and infant mortality and low birth weight, for it seems from what I've read, Black mothers seem to have, that maybe at least regionally. Is that correct, or am I wrong in
that? So the infant mortality rates for Black infants are high. It's highest in Wisconsin relative to the rest of the country. So that's absolutely right. And while maternal mortality is lower in absolute terms in Wisconsin than other states in terms of actual numbers, the relative gap between white and Black mothers is larger. So, Wisconsin is really characterized by a large share of inequities in birth outcomes and maternal health outcomes. And that's really reflective of the overall environment of inequities that we see in Wisconsin in terms of racial disparities in income, wealth, unemployment, incarceration rates. All of those things likely matter to producing these inequities in birth outcomes.
Yeah, no, I read a lot of papers on some of this before, and I think, so now that we've kind of set the stage, I'm wondering What do you think needs to happen in order for those system changes to occur? And then, you know, I believe that there are many things, of course, we can't answer everything all on this call, but what do you think would lead to like a healthier, more equitable society for not just, you know, Black mothers, but for everybody else? What resources do we need and what should we do in order to make sure that, you know, in terms of not just birth outcomes, but systemically, everybody is in an equitable place?
Well, that is a $1 trillion question, but I'll attempt to start here. One, I think that there has been a focus, and I'm glad there's been a focus on Black maternal health of late, because I think when we address the inequities that produce Black maternal health inequities, we can solve a whole lot more problems as well. I do think, though, that when we focus just on the pregnancy period, we signal a couple of things, that women and other birthing people only have value when they're pregnant. And I live with this contradiction, given that I focus on this period of the life stage. But in terms of scientific robustness and in terms of things that are going to work, we can't just focus on the pregnancy period. One, because many people don't intend to get pregnant. Now, pregnancy intention is a problematic measure for reasons we'll get into maybe another time. But the reality is, if we wait until people get pregnant, or we tailor policies just for people who are pregnant, that's too little too late. We need to care about people's growth and development from birth all the way to the end of the life course. What does that mean? One, it means that we have to address these drastic income and wealth disparities. We know that the lack of income, lack of wealth is associated with all kinds of adverse health outcomes. And for many reasons, Black Americans have had disparities in income and wealth that we can trace back to, frankly, enslavement, right? Mm-hmm. And not having the same start that other groups did when they came to the United States. And while we can try to implement different policies to address that, really trying to address that original sin is critical if we're going to make some changes, because that wealth gap is what allows people to progress earlier in life. It allows people to stay healthier. It allows people to have a safety net if things go wrong. Mm-hmm. And in general, the Black-white wealth gaps are massive and need to be addressed first and foremost.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, that's definitely something that I've read papers that talk about that one of the indicators of future success is the ability. I think there was a paper that came, I don't know who it was, that it said that the ability to own a home, you know, is a predictor of, I guess, future outcomes. Am I wrong? I may be wrong on this, but there was some paper that came out some time ago, and that was interesting. You know, it definitely looked at all different areas that it didn't really necessarily, you could get the education, you could get the job, but if you weren't able to establish a place to build wealth, is what we're talking about, you know, having a home and definitely looking for that, you know, as a way to start off and jump off, you know, to make sure that it continues throughout. And that was also interesting. And also, I would definitely would like to hear your take on that as well.
Sure. Homes are certainly an indicator of wealth. We know about past practices that made it more expensive for Black folks to get homes, or even prevented them from getting homes at all. But more than that, what the wealth gap is a product of, according to folks like Sandy Darity and Derek Hamilton, is really in vivo wealth transfers. It's the fact that white Americans have a much greater likelihood of having wealth and resources passed from generation to generation relative to other groups. And as we know, that makes a huge difference. Our taxation system certainly treats income very differently than other kinds of wealth. And because of that, we really have to address wealth gaps, and not in a way that talks about cultural dysfunction or inferiority. This idea that if Black people saved more, they would have better wealth outcomes. Well, there's been evidence that Black people do save just as much, if not more, if we account for actual income levels, right? Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is this is not a story of individual level behavior. It's a story of structural inequality, or let's name it racism, that has to be addressed if Black people are to be on equal footing in terms of wealth and health and well-being.
Yeah. So now that we've, you know, brought up, you know, racism, how do we define it? And I know that scientifically it may be defined differently. And so just for everybody to sort of have a general definition. So what would you consider to be like the racism term? Like, what does it mean?
That's a really broad question, but I would say that racism can occur on various spheres, right? Mm-hmm. So when people say racism, a lot of times they're referring to interpersonal animus or bias directed at members of another racial group, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm much more interested in how this plays out systemically or institutionally, mm-hmm. or the laws or institutions that advantage or disadvantage one racial group relative to another. And so these are the things that matter quite a bit in terms of people's outcomes. For example, some things are not very obvious to people. We've said, well, all we need to do to address COVID is increase unemployment benefits. Well, states where Black people are more populous make it more difficult to get unemployment benefits. That's a really good example of structural racism. Another example of structural racism has come up in COVID. A lot of the employment fields that do not have protection under some of these federal relief acts for COVID are disproportionately employ people of color in general and Black people in particular. And that goes back to when many of these laws, Rukaiya Yerbia, a professor at St. Louis University, I think, writes really, really in-depth treatment of how laws that protected workplaces, you know, 40-hour work week, worker protections, those laws excluded professions like farming, et cetera, where Black people and other people of color were disproportionately represented, right? So that is a form of structural racism that has implications today, because when we're looking at the professions where people have the least protection from COVID in terms of personal protective equipment and workplace conditions, and also have high exposure, they're disproportionately Black and brown. So those are the kinds of examples of racism that are really important to highlight, because it shows people that this is not an individual level story, but a story of legal systems and policies and structures that disadvantage one group in favor of another.
So as you just mentioned with COVID and how it has definitely shown the health disparities, do you think the policies are moving in a direction that is exposing these? And or another question would be, is there even a time frame? I mean, I know this is a bit of a big question for like that push. I know we got a new administration. Do you feel like there's a push towards making sure that these systems that have disenfranchised a lot of, you know, people of color may be broken?
You know, it's hard to say. I think that with the Biden administration has signaled its desire to expand and strengthen the Affordable Care Act. You know, a lot of people, particularly in fields that don't have benefits, right? They don't have medical coverage. They don't have the ability to take off of work if they're feeling sick or feeling symptoms, because they might have families to take care of, right? So I think that should there be a move to expand the ACA to, dare I say, all 50 states, I think that would make a huge difference in making sure that at least a sizable subgroup, the low-income population, would have access to medical care that's not linked to their employment. Okay. That's really important. And I also think that some of this is also has to do with nativity, of course. Immigrants are also disproportionately represented in fields where they're exposed to COVID. They work in meatpacking plants. They work in farming type scenarios that expose them to COVID, and they often don't have the protections that they need. There have been some proposals to expand Medicaid or emergency Medicaid to immigrants who otherwise wouldn't be eligible for that. And while a lot of people think about Hispanic immigrants, we know that in places like Maine, Black people form a very small proportion of the population, but a fairly sizable proportion of the people who are getting COVID. And we know from contact tracing that many of them are immigrants. So when we talk about the immigrant story in the US, that's also Black people's story as well, right? And making sure that people in these vulnerable industries have the protections that they need is a really critical task of policy. And many of these policies also have the potential to disproportionately improve outcomes for Black people.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, I would definitely say that I'm an immigrant. I'm from Uganda, you know, as my last name, it's Insubuga, that's how it's pronounced. And I do, you know, coming from a different country, as you said, you come with a different cultural context, but also just because we're, you know, in this system and in this way of, you know, classifying people, you realize that not everybody has those resources or even that knowledge. And I thank you for also talking about like the immigrant story as well, because sometimes in that immigrant story, they're more than just, you know, certain, you know, sometimes it seems like certain groups are called out more than others, but, you know, it's broader than we think. And I think that is definitely a good point and something to also remember, I think. And also, I have another question. Do you think there are companies, I know there's also that are doing better than they, you know, in this realm. And if not, what could be done to make it, you know, and I know policies where it starts, I totally understand that, but are they companies that are, even if it's small or big, that are trying to make sure that they're doing this as well?
You know, I don't know. That's not something that I think quite a lot about in my own work. I think a lot more about governmental policies that could improve outcomes for certain groups. But I'm sure that some companies are thinking through some of these issues. And hopefully those changes are not superficial or for publicity, but are because, you know, doing the right thing means that more talented people get a seat at the table and we all benefit.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. So in terms of, you've talked about, like, which I really appreciate, the policy. So it's basically making sure that the policies are in place. And can we also talk about the history? We kind of mentioned and hinted at the history before. We can definitely talk about more of the history of how, you know, people of color and African Americans have been disenfranchised policy-wise. I know this means like redlining, just to sort of like, keep everybody in like a context of like, this is what's happening now and what happened in the past so that we can rectify it in the future.
I'm sorry, what was your question?
Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm asking, can we just sort of do like a background, a sort of history of, you know, the policies that have not helped people of color, such African-Americans, to sort of highlight those as well?
Wow, that's a long list of policies, but I will tackle one or two.
Yes.
One thing that I think a lot about is segregation in the Jim Crow South and the impacts that had on Black health and well-being. There's been some really interesting work done by folks like Rucker Johnson at Berkeley that show the link between school desegregation and better health outcomes. He does this really fascinating work where he is able to look at how quickly school districts complied with desegregation orders after Brown v. Board of Education. That was a Supreme Court decision that that declared separate but equal unconstitutional. But some school districts dragged their feet, and it's because of that differences in timing of dragging their feet that he's able to see what happens to Black children that were exposed to these policies more than others. And he finds that their educational outcomes improved. He found that their later life health and well-being was better than their counterparts that didn't get exposure to desegregated school systems. And the story here is not that white people's school systems are better, but it means that when Black people get access to better resources that facilitate learning and education, their outcomes improved. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's really useful to look at the past to understand what policies might work in the present. Similarly, there's been some work on hospital desegregation that implies that hospital desegregation in the South improved infant mortality among Black mothers in particular. Mm-hmm. There's been some recent work that calls that into question, but at least we know that having federal policies that give institutions, let's say, strong incentives to do better, can improve outcomes. So those are a couple of the policies that I'm thinking about in my own work when I'm thinking about, okay, how can we improve these outcomes, particularly among Black women? What policies can change the past, from the past rather, can change the present? And so that's been a focus of a lot of my work.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to do, is sort of like see, like, you know, show people that when you as you said, help the Black community through these policy ways, there's a lot of change, you know, a lot of positive change. And so that is just, you know, really, really reaffirming to sort of, you know, hear it from an expert as yourself, that yes, it is there. Like, if you invest and make sure that there are policies that help, as you say, Black women and, you know, generally the Black African Americans, there is a, there is a shift, there's a positive shift. And then, you know, and I know this is maybe not necessarily related to your field, because you definitely work with Black women. Now there's policing. So, like, I've heard of some papers that talked about, you know, this sort of, I think New York City is the one that had, you know, those different stop and frisk policies and how they kind of looked at different outcomes. So if we, you know, it may not be your field, but I just want to hear your view on what policing, how policing has shaped this narrative of racism in the Black experience as well.
That's a broad question. As you noted, it's not my area. What I can tell you is that there's been some really interesting work from Dr. Rachel Hardiman at University of Minnesota and some other folks that look at policing and the presence of police in neighborhoods and how it affects people's trust in healthcare systems, even if they're not stopped, even if they don't have direct interaction with the police. And they find that, had negative encounters with the police, they're less likely to trust in healthcare systems. Now, why does that matter? It matters because with COVID, this is an infectious disease. We want people to be able to come to doctors. We want people to be able to come to health systems and get the treatment they need. But the problem is that institutions have earned the mistrust of historically excluded and marginalized groups, right? And we can't just turn it on and off because there is a deadly pandemic raging through America and the rest of the world, right? And it also matters that when we talk about enforcement of policies, for example, enforcement of mask wearing, we had evidence pretty early on that Black men were disproportionately punished for not wearing masks relative to their white counterparts, right? So in the context of health, those are two really specific ways that policing could possibly make some reforms to help improve the outcomes that we see with the COVID pandemic. And specifically, if there are mask mandates, making sure that rather than punishing people, that they're actually giving masks to everyone and encouraging them to use masks rather than going for more punitive policies, particularly disproportionately among Black men. The second implication that policing affects people's trust in healthcare systems is a little bit harder to solve in the short term. But I do know that it is going to be a necessary thing to address when it comes to trust in healthcare systems, not just for U.S. born citizens, but also for immigrant families who have had negative experiences with immigration enforcement, or know people that have had negative experiences with immigration enforcement. And even if they are here in an authorized manner, it doesn't matter, right? Because that fear is still there, and that lack of trust of institutions is there. And that has implications for people's willingness to seek medical help and to address symptoms once they come up.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tiffany Green, for talking to us about the effects of racism. I'm definitely really interested in, you know, talking to about this more. I feel like we've hit a few things, but definitely there is more to be talked about, and that there is more to look at. And not only in, like, you know, in the systems and the, you know, in terms of the laws and policies that are in place, that, as you've shown, that definitely help us, you know, as, you know, in the society as a whole, be better and equitable. So definitely, you know, any last thoughts and words that you would like to address, just, you know, thank you.
You know, I think one thing I would definitely say is it's really important for us to address systems rather than just people.
Yes,
yes, it's important for individual level people to interrogate their own biases and prejudices, but those things come from living in a society that reinforces those ideas. So I think that the most important thing we can do is to really focus on how we can change systems, how we can change institutions, how we can change laws that disadvantage Black people and other people of color, you know, people that are poor, people that are disabled. Because I think when we do that, everybody benefits, because everybody can reach their highest potential if we have a society that facilitates that. And that's why we should all care about addressing racism, because that means that we all can be better off as a society. And I think that's a goal worth pushing for.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I think there's, you know, as a system, it's there's more to it than, you know, just the individual story, although it is important. It's just, as you said, like, as a system-based approach, you know, I feel like, you know, there is momentum now, and I really do hope that that momentum is just not momentum, but action. And action, as you said, is through policy. I love your examples of how, and, you know, I've also felt them where, like, in just in places where, you know, people of color can thrive, it's not just because it's people of color. We want everyone to thrive. And I do like your note about, like, you know, people with, you know, who live with disabilities or other issues that they may deal with day to day. We want everybody to thrive. We want more of, like, a equitable society. And that's what I'm hoping for. I don't know if it will happen in my generation. And I was also going to ask about, like, how long and what, you know, what span of generations does that change? But of course, that could be a whole other topic. Thank you very much. And thank you, Perpetual Notion Machine fans. And catch you next time. Thanks.